From the Headstuff Podcast Network, welcome to Mother Folklore, Last Orders, podcast of words, Irish words and words from Ireland. I am Dara Crochet. This is actually going to be our last ever Mother Folklore interview. It's not our last episode, will be coming soon, but the I just wanted, you know, before we are wrapped up, a topic that keeps coming up on Mother Folklore is the Tán and Irish mythology in general, but particularly how this text resonates so deeply with people in a way. Maybe I'm not sure if Greek people care deeply about Greek mythology. I'm sure they do. I'm not sure if English people care deeply about Arthurian narratives. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But certainly in Ireland, people do feel fairly close to their texts. But also, these texts, such as the Tán, have been able to sustain multiple readings, multiple conflicting or complementary or different readings. It's something I wanted to return to in the world that we're in. And I was very lucky that a wonderful guest has agreed to join us today. A master's student in Cork, studying Irish.
Early and medieval Irish, I think is what they call it.
Early and medieval Irish, that'll do the trick. Yeah. Fáilte go mór, Folklore, Finn Longman.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Finn, what kind of stuff are you doing in your research?
So I specialise in medieval Irish literature, and I'm particularly interested in the Ulster cycle, and I'm writing my thesis about the character of Loic Mac Rhiangabhra, who is Cuchulainn's charioteer, and a very neglected character, very interesting character. But in the past, I was looking more at Cuchulainn himself and looking at the ways he's a kind of liminal or transgressive figure, particularly with relation to like gender and queer theory, but also looking a bit about monsters. Love a monster.
And this is the thing, because we often see, when we read kind of child-friendly versions of the Tán, you know, kind of when Cuchulainn turns into a monster, he's kind of like a slightly Hulk-like figure. Maybe he just gets a bit bigger when he turns red. In the text, where his eye kind of dangles out and he has blood hose coming out of his forehead, and it's fairly grotesque.
Yeah, his whole body kind of turns inside out. I actually think people always compare him to the Incredible Hulk, but if you're gonna go for a comic book comparison, I would go for Venom. The Rhea Strad reminds me of, he has a parasite. The Rhea Strad is when it wins. His whole body just becomes this kind of horrifyingly like inside out giant thing. It's very bizarre, and it's always de-weirded in the retellings.
Yes. That's the thing, is it's such a shame to lose some of that weirdness, I think. And a recurring thing, a topic that's kept on popping up for us in when we talk about the Tán, either through the Irish Four account, through the Mother Folklore account, or on the podcast, is this idea that, oh, wouldn't this be a great Netflix series? But I would surely be de-weirded significantly in order to make that happen.
Yeah, I think it's tricky to adapt to like modern visual sensibilities, because a lot of the time I get the impression the authors aren't interested in the kind of visual plausibility. Like, you read the descriptions and they contradict each other and they don't make sense, but it's more about the vibe than about like physically being able to draw it. It's about, well, this is the impression of this kind of inverted figure rather than the literal reality of it. So I think it'd be quite hard to represent visually. I'd be really interested in seeing if someone could represent it through dance or some other kind of more abstract performance art, because I think it's a very sort of physical text more than it's a visual text.
Very much so. And when we talk about the physicality of the text, what would be a good example of that, you know, compared to maybe some of the other medieval things, Sir Orfeo and stuff like that?
Well, I just think there is so much focus on bodies, because it's a text about combat, and it's a text where we have these constant single combats, some of which are very kind of slapstick, with Cuchulainn just throwing spears through people's heads, or like people getting impaled with pillar stones and so on. But also there's this kind of intense physicality and grace to Cuchulainn's own fighting style. He has his like notorious salmon leap, and for example, it's very hard to visualize until you start thinking about kind of Olympic gymnasts and ballet dancers who can contort their bodies into these improbable shapes in the air, and then suddenly you're like, oh, actually, I kind of make sense of this. Whereas when you think of people as very sort of static figures on the ground with swords, it's hard to represent that sort of speed and agility that there is there.
Oh, very much so. And that does make sense. When you think about, I suppose, I guess, English or kind of Welsh texts in a similar period, you might find, yes, there probably isn't always that same emphasis on the body itself, which is something I had the pleasure of reading The Dream of the Rood in college. You know that one?
Secondhand. I've not done much with the old English stuff myself, but a lot of my friends have, especially friends from undergrad, so I kind of get all of their secondhand observations.
You'd think a talking tree would be a lot of fun. No. But so getting to something that connects with controversies and unnecessary controversies in 2021 is that the Ton actually does, as a text, it's frequently mentioned that it responds well to gender focused readings, to queer readings, and readings that that the text represents, that shows certain ideas that are dismissed as modern or faddish, or actually have deep historical roots, not just in not just globally, but also but in Ireland as well. This is the idea we're bombarded by a discourse that, you know, we can't expect people over 32 to understand something as complicated as being transgender or non-binary because these are brand new ideas, and they're not.
Yeah, definitely not. And I think most medieval literature is queerer, or has potential to be read as queerer, than most people anticipate and most people expect. I think we have the Victorians to blame for that. A lot of their retellings, like sort of simplified and imposed Victorian gender ideals on characters, that means it's been kind of obscured to modern readers if they don't have access to the original texts, I think.
Well, very much so. That idea that it's people find it so hard to believe that something as central to, I guess, as central to kind of the ways of understanding the idea of people being greeted as ladies and gentlemen, and the and single sex education, things like that. The idea that something like this might actually have been imposed, and rather than just being the way things always are, and it doesn't take long to implement this is the way things always are kind of a narrative.
Yeah, I think also there's a lot of things like. People often think, oh, well, this binary is very Christian, and therefore it must have like come in with Christianity. But even when you look at medieval Christianity, a lot of like the hagiography and the saints' lives, they don't fit neatly in our boxes. They're a lot more transgressive and interesting and queer than we might anticipate. So I really don't think we can lay that at Christianity's door either. It's much more modern than that.
Yeah, I think some of the excesses of modern internet atheism have made people think maybe the worst people in the world are wrong about everything else. You know, it's like it just seems to be the fact that this common thread of these awful public commentators has been this idea that you can blame religion but not blame the capitalism that runs with it and all the other institutions or the military and things like that are kind of run with it. It's been alarming. So I suppose we'll get down to actually how this reflects in the Ton. Why do you think people say that the Ton is a queer friendly text, or is a text that responds to a queer reading?
So I think it's interesting because this is quite a common discussion on the internet, but it is not a mainstream discussion in academia.
Okay.
It is not something that people have kind of universally accepted. There are one or two articles that explore queer reading. Sarah Sheehan wrote one in 2006 called Ferdia Deflowered, Homoerotics and Masculinity in Kovrak Ferdia. But other than that, there's been kind of very little acknowledgement of those queer potentials, whereas on the internet a lot of people read this and they kind of immediately engage with that. And some of that is just academia being quite conservative in some manners, and some of it is like where Celtic studies has tended to historically happen has been in like quite Catholic environments quite often, so that doesn't help. But yeah, it's one of those things where on the internet everyone's like, oh yeah, I get this, and in academia if you say that it's a bit actually quite controversial sometimes. But I mean, there are a few like starting points, I think, for where you can see those queer potentials in the Ton. And I would emphasize that when I talk about queer readings, I'm like not suggesting necessarily any intent on the part of the authors to portray something that we as modern readers would understand as queerness. It's more that like there's something that we as modern readers can interpret. It's a layer of understanding. And I think the value of a queer reading is it disrupts our assumptions. Because if we stop assuming that everyone in a text is straight and cis, we start looking at how gender roles are constructed in the text. We start looking at where the interesting relationship dynamics are and where the power balance is. And we actually end up with a more nuanced take, even if none of the conclusions we come to are like, this is homoerotic. Like, even if we still assume everyone is straight at the end, at least we've deconstructed it and we've examined what that means within the context of the text. So one of the values of a queer reading is it just makes everything more intentional and more kind of deliberate. And the other reason they're great is because they do allow people to see themselves in their own mythology. The number of people who've come to me and been like, it's so great that you like see Cuchulainn as being someone who could be like me. I really value that. That is one of the reasons I think it's worthwhile, even if that's like not an academic argument for it. But the two areas that people often look at are the relationship between Cuchulainn and Ferdia. And for those who aren't aware, Ferdia is Cuchulainn's like close friend from when he was younger. They trained together under the warrior woman Scothach, and now they come upon each other in single combat and fight to the death, because it's not friendship unless there's a death match involved.
Of course.
So this relationship between them is like one of the first things people interpret as queer. And the other thing is that Cuchulainn himself is quite a problematically masculine figure, which is funny because in artwork he's always depicted as like this hyper-masculine, muscle-strapped figure, which actually the text doesn't support at all. Literally everyone who meets him is like, why is this guy so small? Why doesn't he have a beard? Which every trans guy I know has looked at that and been like, oh, I relate to that experience. So that is quite a good starting point for looking at trans masculine readings of Cuchulainn and looking at ways he transgresses like gender expectations.
Yeah, for sure. And then so much of it is about that is about transformation as well. Yes, that is something, and I know there's a Antoine bot is a wonderful feature, which is it's the Byrne or Burke version of the Antoine is
I think it's Joseph Dunn.
Sorry, that big one. Yes.
Yes. Yes. From like 1914, and he has a interesting approach sometimes. But
yes, definitely, and it's a very interesting text, and being able to read it in bits in small chunks on a day-to-day basis and to roll back, it is interesting that there is often this emphasis on how Cuchulainn and Setanta is called the lad, and they're described as, you know, being quite beautiful, quite vain, and yes, and not using grass to actually make a fake beard to pass to pass as a man.
Exactly. And so there's a really interesting comment from Medhev. And I should just put a note here. All of my pronunciations are very medieval, so they may not sound like the modern Irish ones. This is not just me being English. It is actually me being a medievalist. Anyway,
okay.
So I say Medhev and not Maeve. But yeah, so there's an interesting comment from Medhev near the beginning where she says that Cuchulainn is only the age of a marriageable girl, or only the size of a marriageable girl. So basically, It's a very disparaging comment she's saying, but he's so tiny, he's not old enough for this, like, why are we scared of him? But the fact that she specifically compares him to a girl and nothing else, it's like, she's being dismissive, but it has kind of connotations that you're like, okay, why would she make that comparison? Why would she position him? And it kind of puts him on a level with Medhev's own daughter, who is used as a bargaining piece throughout. It makes these two young people seem more similar than we would have expected. And then throughout, people are constantly like saying Cuchulainn is small, and again, you could dismiss that as just like people who don't like him being like, well, he's tiny, although really they have no motivation to do so, because it's more embarrassing for them to get beaten up by a tiny little kid. Like, you would expect them to exaggerate his size, if anything. But then there's a great moment where he describes himself as a Milbeck, a little creature. He's like, I am just a little creature.
I'm small.
Yeah, he says, this little creature that you see that is me is wrathful. And it's, meal is actually the same word that's used to describe like insects. It's a very kind of derogatory word for a small, low creature. The fact that he uses it for himself, and he's such a proud person, you can't imagine himself like calling himself small if he wasn't actually small. So, yeah. And then the false beard thing, yeah. He, on multiple occasions, he has to adopt a fake beard, one time with blackberry juice, one time with grass and magic. And the fact that he uses magic is always interesting to me. It's kind of an illusion that he's creating there. And it's he doesn't seem bothered by it. Like, if he was bothered by it, he would wear a fake beard all the time. It's just that when other people question him, he's like, guess I gotta conform to your norms now. So
that's a great point. And the idea that, yes, it's that the disguise is a hassle.
Yeah. And like, he's 17, and in old Irish law, the age of full adulthood was the age of beard encirclement, which was supposed to be 20. So the fact that they're emphasizing his lack of a beard, they're pointing out that he doesn't yet meet this legal category of adult. He's too young. But the fact that like his beardlessness is unexpected to them, I think is one of the things that makes it so intriguing, because surely they know how old he is. And it's, I mean, there's lots of parallels. Like, Achilles is often described as beardless, even when he's an adult. We see it in the sort of middle high German texts. I think some of them are beardless when they're like nearly 30. And Lancelot in Lancelot du Lac, he's 17 in that as well. Mm-hmm. And he's described as a beardless boy. So it is kind of part of this broader range of heroic beauty. But it's unusual because Cuchulainn kind of seems insecure about it, the way that other people kind of respond to it. He's like, okay, I guess I have to do something about this. He could just prove them wrong. He could just beat them up without a beard. Yeah. But he feels the need to do what they require. It reminds me of like when my friends kind of have to hyper perform gender to get gender clinics to take them seriously. They're like, well, I guess I have to wear makeup because otherwise they won't believe me. But beauty is often a masculine thing in Irish texts, which I think is unexpected to modern readers.
Yeah.
But Naoise and Froich and Cuchulainn, they're all described as beautiful. And there's a really interesting poem about the kings of the Ulath and so on, which makes comparisons between medieval heroes and classical heroes. And it says that Naoise is equivalent to Paris because their beauty caused the Trojan War and the Tyne.
Oh.
Which, blaming the Trojan War on Paris rather than on Helen is fascinating.
That's what I'm thinking. That is fascinating.
And then suggesting that it's Naoise's beauty that's the problem. That's why Deirdre ran away with him. That's what started the Tyne. Like, again, that's a take. And it shows that we shouldn't think, oh, beauty, that's automatically feminine. Like, actually, their constructions of masculinity are not the same as ours, which is why it's so useful to, like, take away our assumptions and sort of strip back and be like, okay, look, how is gender being constructed and presented in this text? Because if we just assume it's the same as the modern one, we're going to miss those kind of interesting points.
Very much so. And I mean, that's a really fascinating point. And I'll be thinking about that all day. I'll be mentioning that in the conversations I end up in. And when we talk about it, and obviously when people think about gender and the Tyne, the inevitably Queen Maeve, as you pronounce it, comes up, and the idea that she's such a formidable female character, and it's, it was often pointed out. I remember we had a teacher in school say that, you know, a lot of fairy tales traditionally end in a wedding, but a lot of Irish mythologies, they begin with a wedding and then things go wrong. And that may have just been how, like, Lady Gregory kind of anthologized them rather than actually a genuine trend in narrative history. But it does start effectively with almost like a divorce, a couple deciding who owns how much what and how much of what, and design is on the split.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because that opening is only in one version of it. So we have three recensions, so that's like distinct versions of the Tyne. The first one is in Levonahira and Yellow Book of Lecan, among other manuscripts. The second one is in the Book of Leinster, and then there's a version that we call Recension 2b, which is in a much later 15th century manuscript. And then Recension 3 is sort of 14th century, and it's a bit fragmentary. And so the pillow talk episode, as they call it, is only in the Book of Leinster, or it's an innovation of the Book of Leinster. I think it does show up later. So the first recension actually just kind of starts in media res. They are invading Ulster. We don't know why. They haven't told us why. There's a few different reasons that it could be, because we have some other stories that provide a backstory. So there's one called Toynbee Regophon, which like provides a motivation there. And in fact, the Pillow Talk episode where they are splitting up their wealth and deciding who owns what is like never alluded to in the body of the Tyne itself. Like they never kind of hark back to it. They never say, oh yeah, but what about this? And so it kind of is, it does seem like possibly the person who compiled the version that ends up in the Book of Leinster created that because it needed to have a more coherent start. And that was the story they decided to tell. And it's interesting that the Book of Leinster version, some people have said it's much more misogynistic than the first recension. It presents Medivh in a much more negative light in places, and it has some more sort of disparaging comments about like this is what happens when you listen to women sort of thing. So the fact that they make this a kind of marital dispute rather than, for example, if we take the Toynbee Regophon background, it's otherworldly shenanigans going on, which is obviously like on a much more bigger mythological scale. And they've instead made it about like, oh, there's this disagreement. And the reason Medivh doesn't have a bull to match Alil's is because it was her bull originally and it went over to Alil's herds because it didn't want to be led by a woman. So it's all tying into those kind of the gender elements that are emphasized in the Book of Leinster version.
Yeah, that's an interesting point about it. It only being one part of the text, but it's certainly become very popular in the translated versions in the 21st and 20th century.
Like it's one of those things also where when you just read in the sort of mainstream translations like Kinsella's and Carson's, which are great translations, but it kind of obscures the fact that what we have is not a single text. We actually have multiple versions that sometimes contradict each other and sometimes do things a little bit differently, and some of them have bits missing as well, so you do have to look at more than one manuscript because sometimes there's some pages gone. And if we just started in the middle of nowhere with no explanation, we wouldn't know what was happening. So that's why the Pillow Talk episode gets put in always, because it does provide the sort of neatest explanation for what's going on.
Yeah, it does. It creates a clarity, and I suppose, and particularly, it adds a poignancy or a significance to the two bulls fighting at the end.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting in the Toynbee Regophon backstory that kind of Medivh's desire there was to see the two bulls fight. She was like, "I will not be happy until I see these two bulls fighting," kind of thing. So that was her goal all along. Whereas in the Tyne, it's like, oh, well, that seems like nobody won here because nobody got these animals. They're just dead. But also, like, because so many of their body parts become parts of the landscape, some people have theorized it originally was a sort of a remnant of a creation story or a remnant of some kind of topographical myth, because it ties into the Dinn Chenahas, the law of place names. Like so much of the Tyne is about place names. Like this person died here, that's why it's called that. That person died there, that's why it's called that. This part is the bull's shoulder, you know. So it has these kind of huge implications for the Irish landscape. But for the characters themselves, it's a bit like, oh, this whole thing was a little bit pointless.
That's the thing, and I know some people have said that it's an early anti-war text, but that might be imposing a modern position on it. I mean,
I think it does seem to have a critical viewpoint of violence. Like it very much seems to present violence as something that needs to be tempered by prudence, by good judgment. And especially, I think, once we get to the point for Cuchulainn's Lament for Ferdia, where so much of it is about how futile everything seems after this desperate, violent death, it sort of starts to look more critical. And there are definitely some scholars who like look at this as a sort of clerical anti-war viewpoint, because obviously it is being written, in the version we have it, it's being written in monasteries. And Crusades aside, like the Christian church generally like vaguely anti-war. So I don't think it's necessarily an anachronism to suggest there's some anti-war ideals coming through in places, and it certainly seems like not uncritical of this heroic topos of violence, you know.
The World According to Wikipedia is a podcast that pops the hood of Wikipedia and invites you to take a look inside.
Each episode, we will talk to someone from the Wikimedia community on topics like, why are only 18% of biographies about women? Can editing Wikipedia be a protest or activism? And what is it like for the communities working on the 200-plus Wikipedias that are not in English?
Subscribe on your podcatcher of choice and follow us on Twitter at world_Wikipedia.
Let's talk a little bit more about Freud and Kukulcan and the fact that they were foster brothers, as I said. And
yeah.
And some people think, oh, it's jumping to conclusions to see a romantic or sexual relationship there. But is it? I don't think it's jumping to conclusions.
I don't think so. So there's a few things about Kukulcan and Ferdia's relationship that are worth mentioning. So they're foster brothers because they were taught by Skothach. And there are several other opponents that Kukulcan comes across in the town who were also trained by Skothach and who have this same relationship. And I mean, some of them, like Firbith, I think is one of the early ones he fights, and he does try and talk him out of it and like appeals to their friendship and says, you know, I don't want to do this. But after he's killed Firbith, he just kind of gets over it.
Yeah.
And he doesn't seem affected by any of these other deaths in the way that he is affected by Ferdia's. So I think this is a sign that there is something different about their relationship. And there's something different about the nature of that bond. And people often take the manner of Ferdia's death as the starting point for a queer reading and as a starting point for looking at homoerotics, because he is killed through the use of the gabolga, which is like this exploding spear that is inserted through the anus and then eviscerates people from the inside, which is obviously like completely awful and horrifying on all levels. But because it's like this phallic weapon and the way it is used, people then go, oh, maybe this is a bit gay. Mm-hmm. I actually think that's quite problematic as a starting point for the homoerotics. Like, it's equating queerness with this act of desecrating violence and this like profound violation of the body, which I'm quite uncomfortable with. You know, suggesting that sexualized violence is equivalent to queerness is like, that's a bit dodgy once you think about it. Like, I know people do start there, and it is a starting point, but I don't think it's the place we should stay. Well, I'm much more interested in looking at Kukulcan's lament for Ferdia, which happens immediately afterwards for a few reasons, but mostly like it's the only time in the time that he has this kind of reaction, that he expresses this profound regret for what has happened. It's kind of the emotional climax of the text, but I also think it's the point where Kukulcan grows up. He's a 17-year-old boy. He seems invincible. And this is the closest he comes to death. But it's also the first time he loses something that means something to him. And he says, all play, all sport, until Ferdia came to the ford. In other words, like, none of this mattered until now. And he suddenly is forced to face up to what mortality is and what death is. Like, these death matches are not just, who's going to win this game? It's, oh my goodness, someone I cared about is dead forever. And the profoundness with which he like struggles with that loss immediately after Ferdia's death, he's just kind of immobilized by grief, and he's arguing with his charioteer Loegas, saying, you know, get up, you can't stay here, they're gonna send more people after you. And he's like, I can't, like, none of it means anything. And Loegas says, you know, like, you're wounded, Ferdia, he would have killed you. And Kukulcan says, he could have cut off my arm, my leg, and still I would mourn Ferdia of the steeds, who was part of me and breathes no more.
Mm.
And that's from Carson's translation, which is probably the most poetic, maybe not the most literal. But like the idea, he's like, he could have cut off my arms and I would still be sorry that he's dead, which we've never seen him express about anyone else in the text. Everyone else is like, well, they got what was coming to them.
Yeah.
And then we get the fact that he like focuses on Ferdia's beauty, on, he's like, I miss your blush, your clear eye. He keeps focusing on his body in ways that are very reminiscent for how we see women talking about their lovers in other texts. It's how, when we see like Deirdre and Levachem discussing Nisha in Longer's Macnishlan, they're like, oh yeah, he has, you know, this, his cheeks are red as blood with his blush and stuff. And now we're getting those same images evoked by Kukulcan for Ferdia, and then that's even leaving aside all their evocations of their youthful training, where they used to share a bed and they used to go into adventures together. And obviously bed sharing is not the same connotations in the medieval period as it is now, but we can see they're very intimate friends, which we just don't see with any of the other foster brothers. So it's definitely an unusual relationship that they have there.
Definitely. It is an unusual relationship. And that's, it's definitely worth examining those points. And we had said earlier there was, regarding particularly with Cúchulainn and Ferdia, there's whether or not, I mean, the Tuan is an outlier among texts of this period. I know arguably it's not one period, it's multiple periods. Mm. But there was, but it is an outlier in terms of, emotional detail.
Yeah, I mean, it's a longer text. We don't have that many big, long Irish texts like this. There's Aglaonna Seanóireach, but that is more of a compilatory text. So that has a frame tale of Oisín and Cailte talking to St. Patrick and telling him lots of stories. But it is lots of individual stories within the frame tale, whereas the Tine is like one continuous tale, and we don't have very many others that are as long and as elaborate as this. Also, some people think that the Cofrech Ferdia episode is a later development in the story compared to some of the like earlier combats, partly because of the style it's written in, the language is a bit later, the descriptions are more elaborate, and it's closer to the Fianagecht, the Finn cycle material, than to some of the other Ulster cycle material, because it's that much more kind of florid emotional detail, which is moving towards the slightly more romance literature that we get in the later medieval period, rather than the sort of very stripped back epic of the earlier medieval period. So it definitely has a kind of opportunity for depth that a lot of the others don't have, just by being so big and having so many different elements to it, and also having those later elements. And it's notable also that the Cofrech Ferdia episode is more verse in it. So the Tine as a whole is prose, which is complicated for the question of whether or not it counts as an epic, because some people think that epics have to be a poem. But it's prose in metrum, so it's prose and then it has verse bits scattered through it. But the Cofrech Ferdia episode has a lot more verse, and it has verse dialogues, which are generally a later innovation compared to just weird, obscure prophecy poems that we get earlier in the story. Mm-hmm. So the fact that they have these conversations in verse, which in Carson's translation, he makes them rhyme, and it sounds like they're having a rap battle, which is one of my favorite things about Carson's translation, is these old Irish rap battles that we've got going on. I think that is also like moving into that later romance literature, which has these more personal moments and these more emotional moments.
Great stuff. So Laeg is a great character who isn't maybe a household name the way I think like Ferdy has a very popular name. Satanta's a popular name. Maeve's a popular name. A little less so.
Yeah.
And I mean, when I drop my kids off to creche or school even, I mean, I see the other names. I'm interested in names people picked. No one's calling their son's Laeg.
No, well, no one's calling them Cúchulainn either. I think it's a bit too famous.
Cúchulainn, there's a few Cúchulainns.
Yeah.
And but I know there's a bit of vampire in there, but also Satanta is actually reasonably popular. I think my wife suggests that calling her son Cúchulainn would be like calling them Superman. And
I do know at least one trans person who has called themselves Cúchulainn, I just think is bold. I love it. Mm-hmm. But I went for Finn because I thought that was like more attainable level of heroism. Mm.
This is, and I've often said that that trans people who pick Irish names instead of people who are just born with them are the truest scales of all. Because I mean, there's a lot of people out there with Fionnuala with the silent GH and so on, and who think, oh, you know, what have my parents done to me? But for someone to actually say, you know, this is the real me, and I'm taking this name, and I'm putting silent letters out, and I'm doing this, that's absolutely hardcore. But I suppose, where was I spinning off of that one? Calf.
Yes, so calf, or figuratively in old Irish, it can also mean favourite, or darling, or beloved, which my group chat took about as well as can be expected. So his name, Loic Macariangavra, sometimes spelled Loic Macariangavra, so you can kind of pronounce it however you want because the vowels always change. His name, so Rian Gavra, it seems to come from two elements, Rian or Srian and Gavra. So Gavra comes from Gavor, which is a word for horse, particularly a white horse and mare. And then Rian can mean path, or Srian means bridle. So either path of a horse or bridle of a horse. So it's very much a charioteer's name. And we see a few other charioteers with this patronymic. And then the first element, either calf or favorite charioteer, is literally his name. It's like they went, oh yeah, Chariot McChariot Face. Like, they just want to emphasize that he's the top charioteer of the stories. So that Johnny is literally Chariot, what his name means. Yeah, which does amuse me, I think, and it does very much like emphasize that his entire identity revolves around his role as Cuchulainn's charioteer, and yet he's very neglected because he shows up in like nearly every story. He often has a speaking role and sometimes actually has a much more major role than that. Like in Shergalgar Con Cullen, he goes to the other world on Cuchulainn's behalf, and it is implied that he does this regularly. They're like, oh yeah, Sloig, who often walks the sheath. And I'm like, can we circle back to that? Like, okay, he just goes to the other world for fun. And he often has this very significant role in sort of restraining Cuchulainn's more dramatic flights of fury and acting as a mediator and acting as a messenger. And yet when you look at the academic commentaries on these texts, he gets like mentioned in passing or in a footnote. If you look in the index, there'll be like maybe half a dozen references at best in a full-length book about the time. And like, this bothers me, especially when people are always like, oh yes, Cuchulainn goes there alone, except for Loic. I'm like, I am once again asking when we will start counting Loic as a person. Like, he has this whole character arc. He is the original sassy sidekick. His whole job is like insulting Cuchulainn. And yet nobody seems to think he's worth writing about, which is why I'm doing my thesis on him.
That's the thing. And Loic has these great lines just from the Tun version. You see, like, oh, you know, like Loic is there saying, that tryst with those women last night was a bad idea. You know, we shouldn't have done that. And oh, you know what? And as for this other thing, you know, I foretold to you that this would happen. It's like, you know, I told you so.
Yeah, he's has this kind of curbing. He's the mum friend. He's the one who's just like, ugh, really? You're going to do this? Now I have to go get you out of trouble. Like, he's both the designated driver and the mum friend. And
the mum friend. But the, so Loic is that kind of friend character. But at the same time, there's a little bit more in that the actual, the significance of the relationship, there's possibly more going on than just chariot riding.
Yeah. So it's an interesting one because a lot of what we see of their relationship, it doesn't really come from the Tyne directly. I mean, it does in that, like, Loic is his only companion throughout most of it. He's alone defending Ireland for like 4 months, 5 months. And Loic is the only person with him for a lot of that time. So we know that they play Fifth Curl together, which is like a board game precursor of chess.
Yeah.
And we know that Loic can beat him about 50% of the time, which, considering that Cuchulainn's otherworldly father invented the board game, shows that they play together a lot and that Loic really understands how Cuchulainn's mind works, because he can beat him at strategy games. And that also shows that they're kind of intellectual equals, that they can do that. But then we look at other texts, and I think particularly when we look at the early modern developments of the text, which is something I've been looking at recently, like after the medieval period, we start to get more emphasis on Loic, which means we get some really interesting portrayals of him. And some of this is a class thing, I think. There's more interest in these lower class characters. So in the early modern version of The Death of Cuchulainn, Loic doesn't die. He dies in the medieval version right before Cuchulainn does. But in the early modern one, he just gets wounded and Cuchulainn like sends him away from the battle, says, please take the news back to Ever of my death. Like, I don't want you to get hurt. And they have this really emotional conversation where he's like, you know, since the day we bound ourselves together, we have never once parted day or night. And he's like, no one's ever had a charioteer like you, nor will they ever again. So it's this really kind of emotional friendship that they have there. And also the, you know, I like to joke that it's also very homoerotic, where they're not parting day or night. And later Ever references how they all, the three of them, lived together. It was peaceful, our company, until now, in one dwelling place. So, you know, medieval OT3 going on there. But yeah, so there is this really close friendship there. And then when you start looking at these late developments, there's a version of Comperc Con Cullen, which is the sort of birth of Cuchulainn, that is found in a 15th century manuscript called Royal Irish Academy MSD.4.2. It's not important enough to have a
catchy name.
Yeah, so that's actually, it's a 12th century text probably, but it's in a 15th century manuscript, and that has a whole addition at the end of the story where basically Loig's parents nurse Cuchulainn. Loig's mother is Cuchulainn's wet nurse, and Loig is still young enough at that point to have been on the breast when Cuchulainn is born, so they are similar age, and they grow up together from infancy as foster brothers. And we don't see that tradition in a lot of places, but we do see it in the early modern Death of Cuchulainn, where he addresses him as his covilter, his foster brother. So again, we have this kind of fosterage intimacy coming back, and it's like, okay, so like, how do we interpret the broader spectrum of Loig within that context?
Gotcha. That's the idea that fostering is kind of linked to this kind of this intimacy, and and between the Ferdia situation and the Loig situation, it's interesting that I suppose the way the recruitment process for the Red Branch Knights seems to have similar elements too.
Yeah, and there are other parallels between Ferdia and Loig as well in the early modern material, because we don't have many references to Ferdia outside the Tyne. It's a little bit like, oh, he's his best friend. Why have we never heard of him before? He does show up in passing in Tochach Ever, the wooing of Ever. But then most of the other texts he's referenced in are early modern ones. But in the Stow version of the Tyne, which is the 15th century manuscript of Recension 2, not only does this kind of heighten the relationship between them, there's a line in the poem that Ferdia speaks when he first finds out he has to fight Cuchulainn, and he says, "Alas, O God, that a woman should come between me and him, because the faultless hound is half my heart and I am half of his."
Oh.
Which I have it on my wall, it makes me cry. But later in that same poem he says, "The same grave to me as to him, like bury us together," which is interesting in the context of another early modern text, Torgecht Gruger Grienhalas, The Pursuit of Gruith Grienhalas, in which Loig also says that he wants to be buried with Cuchulainn, which, where have we seen this before?
Yeah.
Ever says it at the end of the Death of Cuchulainn in the early modern version, and like, she's his wife, so it makes sense for her to say it, but the fact that both Ferdia and Loig also want to be buried with Cuchulainn, this is getting to be quite a crowded grave.
Very much so. Yeah, that's an alarming thought. And gosh, yeah. So I mean, before we wrap up, I mean, this was what version of the Tyne do you like most? What would you be recommending? Or is that a terrible question to ask?
It's a terrible question because I think there are. It depends what you want out of the text. You know, like if you're just coming at it like, I've never read this story, I'd like to read it, then either Kinsella or Carson's translation is like, that's fine, that's going to be enough. Obviously, I'm always playing around with the different recensions and like looking at what different authors have prioritized in their tellings. So Cecile O'Rahilly edited and translated them in the 60s and 70s, and her versions are actually online on the Celt website. But they're interesting for sort of exploring. The Stow version hasn't had a translation into English. Like, that poem hasn't been translated fully into English. It's been translated into German. Obviously, by the time you get to 15th century Irish, if you've got modern Irish, it's okay to sort of muddle through. It's the medieval stuff that's hard. Which is the same also with Adas Cuchulainn or I Cuchulainn, because that's in early modern Irish, and some of the manuscripts are like 18th century, 19th century. People who have modern Irish can more or less read it. You just have to like take some of the letters out, and then it looks.
Yeah, it's. I guess exactly. It's almost like kind of a Dineen entry rather than kind of actual proper old Irish.
Yeah. Whereas for me, as someone whose modern Irish is still at Duolingo level, I sit there with a dictionary and cry. But yeah, I mean, in terms of versions of the Tyne, like I wouldn't. The only exception, I say that the Stow version hasn't been translated. Actually, Joseph Dunn's translation, which is the one that Antoine but recounts, does include bits of Stowe. He sort of mixes all of the manuscripts together, and it's one of the reasons his version of the fight with Ferdia is very, very long, because the Stowe version has all of these additions to it and this whole poem, and then there's some supernatural helpers who don't show up anywhere else, which means whenever the Antine book gets to that point, it takes about 3 weeks for it to tweet the whole thing.
Oh yeah, 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 completely.
If it did Book of Leinster or something, it would be way quicker. If it did Recension 1, it would be even quicker still, because in that one, the fight only lasts a day.
Gotcha, I suppose that defeated the purpose of tweeting it slowly out.
Yeah. Yeah, but yeah. It is very much all about what you're looking for in a text, I guess.
Good stuff. Well, I think you can't go wrong with the Kinsella version, and the Carson version, if you can get your hands on it, is a very attractive and accessible one too.
Yeah.
Finn, we love to ask all our guests what their favourite Irish word is. What are we cutting on the hop there?
So mine is, unexpectedly, it's Felachon, butterfly.
Oh, excellent.
So I grew up in England, in a family that didn't really know anything about Irish, didn't care about Irish. And I got into it via children's novels. And when I was about 12, I was online and I found this website that promised to teach me Irish through flashcards. It was like a very early precursor of Duolingo. Mm. And I didn't get very far. I learned how to say hello. And then I learned some animals and, you know, madra and beau and Felachon. Mm. And for some reason, the word Felachon, it was so different from the English word. And it was so interesting as a word to me. It was sort of the first time it clicked that Irish was a real language that real people spoke, not just in fantasy novels, but like in real everyday life, there were people who spoke Irish. And for me, as someone like who had no exposure to it, I was like, oh wow, like this is a whole thing that I didn't know about. And then I didn't really work on my Irish for the next 10 years, but that word, I remembered it. And that's always going to be like kind of the one I attribute as being the first word of Irish I learned, even if it wasn't technically. It's the one that stuck and it's the one that meant something.
Well, there you have it. That's the one that clicked.
Yeah.
Finn Longman, thank you so much for joining us today. Where can people find your work?
So I am always rambling about medieval stuff on Twitter at Finn Longman. I also have a blog, finnlongman.com. And at the moment, I am working through Standish O'Grady's The Coming of Cuchulainn and analysing his interesting choices that he makes. So that is the kind of thing I get up to on the internet. But yeah, I'm basically just at Finn Longman everywhere that you could expect to find me. And I never shut up.
Of course. And please never do. Finn Longman, thank you so much for joining us today. Yeah. So until next time, this is Slán from me.
Slán.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
It'll be usually me swearing at the internet.
So. Good stuff. That's all.